Station number 13717, Lieutenant Colonel Charles G. Reel 17.
Colonel G, Reel 17, we were talking about your time in the POW camp at the castle, and we were talking about letters. You said you wrote regularly. Were there any? Were they censored or?
They were all censored at both ends. I think we had 3 letters and 4 postcards a month we could write, that type of thing. And we could receive as many as we liked. My wife wrote very often, and I had 3 methods of sending them. So if we were going to a new camp, I could, she would get a letter quickly for me, because I'd send one through Switzerland, Rotarian Club in Switzerland, to get home in no time, another one in Portugal, and then there's the ordinary Red Cross one.
And what would you write about? You mentioned one chap, you used to say what a terrible time he was having. What would you say? What type of thing?
Say we've moved to another camp.
No, but generally, when you were in it.
I just tried to keep her happy all the time. And so did most people, I think.
And another point we were going to cover was the concert parties or sort of entertainment in that field, you know.
Yes, all I can remember of the lower camp is I can remember in the lower camp fairly early on doing. I think it was more a parade than a acting, a sort of Christmas do. And I think I was Herod. I know my mother-in-law said, why not Jesus? But it was Christmas do. It was one of the bright little box. Then later, in the top camp, we'd go to a musical party and a number of concerts of various kinds, and we acted 2 Shakespeare plays. The Germans were thrilled with that and would do anything possible to help. They all turned up, and plays had to be acted twice or so.
So who would provide all the costumes and the instruments?
The Germans did. We paid for them, but they, I think I'm right in saying that main of the war, though Berlin was being bombed by us, they had 2 Shakespeare plays running and 2 Bernard Shaw plays, pretty well all the time. And they reckoned Shakespeare was German somehow, but they all thrilled with it. I acted Brutus in Julius Caesar, mainly because I could learn the 400 lines quickly. I'm no actor. I acted a small part in Henry V. And then in Poland, we did an unknown thing. I think I've known about Good Friday. I had a part of quite a big part in that, and I've got it wrong. Sometimes we had 3 performances there because it was a very small place. And then in the big camp, which we're coming on to, was one tremendous sort of pantomime too. I remember in a very, very big marquee.
Well, let's move on now. So we'll now look at things more. We've been looking at things more thematically, you know, and perhaps we could tie it up. But what would a typical day be like? Let's say the upper camp.
Typical day would be pretty boring, I think, really. One would get up.
About what time?
About 8, I suppose. And have a tiny bit of breakfast, a bit of bread and something, or a drink of coffee, imitation coffee.
What was that like, the Erstatt's coffee?
Well, one got used to drinking it. It was made of some sort of wheat or something, brown, burnt. But you got used to it as a hot drink. And read or something to lunch or walk about. A lot of people did systematic walks on the round around the moat, which was quite pleasant. I mean, there were trees in some parts of it, and slopes, and it wasn't undue, and Of course, a lot of people sewed and stitched and did.
Now, you mentioned, that was one of your hobbies, wasn't it?
Yes.
That's interrupted.
What started your cross-stitch pattern and canvas and this one in the passage outside. And we were able to send those home during the war, and I sent quite a number home. Didn't all arrive. I did a pram cover for my youngest daughter. The best and most valuable things I did, just as I was running out of wool, I wrote a letter to the daughter I'd seen, who was about a year old when I became a prisoner, and then I wrote one, or a similar thing, the very last bits of wool I had. That one with Dear Sarah, just carefully done like a letter, and very carefully done, so the lines ended in a straight row. It took a long time, but it's hanging on the wall now in our house. And the other one, the child I hadn't seen, was just greet the unseen with a cheer, and some sort of decorative border. But one I had with 20,000 stitches, it got lost on the way home. I was not good at it, but I did learn a lot of stitches.
And then that was just to keep you busy?
To keep one busy. It takes a long time.
And did you have any other hobbies? I should have asked before.
No, I don't think so.
The other thing, that's also brought another thing. You were an older man, as we've discussed, in your 40s, and you did have a family, seen and unseen. Did that cause you to get very homesick, or more homesick than some of the younger men who perhaps didn't have ties at home?
I don't know. I think it probably did. But when we had everything taken away from us, I made a knife that took me about a fortnight. Out of the things you scrape your feet on, a bar loose somewhere, got a piece of it, and with unlimited time, you tie a string round one end of the handle and sharpen the rest, and plenty of stone in the castle, you see. And it was a very, very good knife. Germans eventually took it from me and it was used in the parcel room. And it probably still lies somewhere.
But, I mean, so you got very homesick then, did
yes,
you?
I think one did.
Did it depress you, or did you?
Oh, well, for a bit, yes. But I felt that it was to keep busy, and a lot of people did nothing, you see, and they just dreamt the time away.
So in the morning, you'd perhaps do a bit of cross-stitching, or would you do perhaps your job in the kitchen?
I'd go to the kitchen with some time there. What I didn't mention about food is some American parcels had all sorts of things in, and my room 13, we had a mess and made a few extra parcels as well as the Red Cross, and one of us made a pudding each week, I suppose with raisins and things to go in. The one thing we didn't have ever was flour, and I made a number of cakes, but cakes without flour don't last long. And of course, we'll grind up biscuits and so on. But it's hardly worth doing, and it did make a change. But making a pudding is a big do. And one person's always hating it, so I kept sucking his finger and going on with his sucked fingers and sucking them again. But he was a clumsy, losing person. Each day there was a lot of silence, boredom, or reading, or something, rather just doing very little.
And then would you actually, you'd go to the dining room at...
Go to the dining room for lunch, and then that would mean meeting other people before and after, something on movement, the washroom nearby. There wasn't anything much to go to see. You had to make your own visits, but there would be bridge parties on them. Gambling, if you wanted to go and look at it.
So that's
what
you did.
It was a big library with people working. Quite a lot of books, not really exciting, but various people contributed books at the beginning, or various. Quite a lot of books of sorts. And I suppose everybody did read a good bit. Nobody had bad eyesight then.
So it was in the afternoon you'd carry on with that?
Yes, snow for a bit.
And then an evening meal?
Evening meal. Two meals in the dining room a day. And might have chocolate or something you could eat on your own. But it was pretty boring.
And in the evening, just carry on the same?
Just carry on.
But and about what time to bed?
We were working with the wireless. It was quite a big deal. It took hours each day we used it. And it was normal that it would be each day.
And then what time to bed?
I can't remember. I had some moderately early, 10 or something like that.
And was there ever, just one point, was there ever any drink in the camp? Could you, I mean, would they ever provide beer or wine for you? Or would anybody distill it?
A little. I don't think we did. I can't remember any.
No distilleries then?
No. Oh, yes, some people did make in the big camp we haven't yet talked about. Some people
okay.
poisoned themselves there.
So that was a typical day. How long were you... Now, you went from the lower camp to the upper camp,
yes.
And you've been to Poland.
I went to the lower camp again for a spell.
And then how long had all this taken?
Well, it's difficult to remember the time, but there were 5 years to fill altogether. And that's on. And a very short time in the lower camp, and then upper camp, then a bigger time in the lower camp when I first took on the kitchen, and then upper camp again with Poland as a sort of interlude.
Did you ever have any foreign officers there, or foreign, but officers from other nations, either, you know, French or...
Swiss, Americans, I think were our supervisors at first until they joined in the war, and then it was Swiss. Come down with complaints at the big camp we went to.
When would you think you went to the big camp?
About a year and a half before the end. They tried to get every British officer into one camp, and they did succeed in getting them all in except for one main RAF camp, which was some way away, where that big escape took place, and 50 were shot or something.
And you don't remember the name of the big camp, but...
6B. It wasn't terribly far from where we had been. And
about how many men would be in that camp?
3,000, counting orderlies, and quite a number of orderlies. There were 50, did nothing but peel potatoes. But they were used by the Germans for various purposes.
And what was that camp like? How was it laid out? It wasn't a castle, of course.
Just a great big square or oval field with huts, masses of huts and a few big marquees. And it was a bosh altogether, very dull.
Was it as comfortable as it had been in the castle?
Well, it was a day or two in a big business hut, I think, and then in another big room was the rest of the staff, like the librarian and others' kitchen and something else. It was rather boring for us because we didn't know each other. And we didn't
so you took on as kitchen officer there as well?
Yes, I had to. Same commander officer. So General Fortin was there. He got this brigadier. I remember his name, but it was I said yesterday, from the Gloucesters, who was younger and more efficient. But it's a lot of people enjoyed it enormously because all prisoners, nearly all prisoners, were there, and there were lots of people from the old Gettonians. People went round coffee housing. There was a lot of food there. Pretty well everybody had a lot of food. There was a lot of public food that I could use in the kitchen. And
these were from Red Cross parcels?
As well as Red Cross parcels. Extra.
Private food.
Tons of it, and Red Cross parcels. The exciting part there was a Russian camp, almost adjoined to it, where they were dying 30 a day of starvation. We had already been told by our SBO at Spanienburg the Russians are awful people. They eat each other. Well, that's because the Germans didn't feed them. They ate a German, in fact, I think, killed one and ate him. But the Germans, a lot of Russians they used for work, but you can't get work out of it unless you give them something to eat. And these were dying of starvation, and my very nice Feldwebel, Sergeant Major in the kitchen, was terribly sorry for them, and he suggested we should give them our spare food. Well, we did, and so there was a lot. But the first time we loaded some sort of van with food, the Germans taking it into the Russian camp nearly got killed in the rush, so it was forbidden. And then we wangled it on again, and providing it was something like stew, could be distributed easily, they let it go on for days. And it didn't cost us any much because there was quite a lot left. And stew with German food in doesn't keep for a day. So if it was made with Red Cross parcels, it would, but if it was made only with German food, or with any German food in, it wouldn't really be pleasant to eat the next day. But I was busy in that big camp with things like, I don't know how I did it, sorting out sugar and giving everybody a fair share of it as fast as possible. Sugar carrying red sacks that one couldn't lift. I don't know how we did it, but it did get done, and as fair as possible. And Weldon had to send it rather in bulk to some group in the camp, and they've got to work out their own distribution.
And one thing I want to ask, were you aware that the officers were better treated than the men in the, you know, other ranks?
Don't think they were. The men had jobs, and it's an awful business not having a job. I mean, you're left to yourself to rot or find a job, make yourself a hobby. And I think the men, I have our own men that we met in Poland, very cheerful, delighted to see their officers there, but they were all right. But some men had some fairly grim work in salt mines, I think, as far as I know.
So as long as the job wasn't horrible, then the men were, you felt that the men were probably better off in a sense because they had something to do.
Yes, something to do. And they were as well fed as anybody else, probably. Well, they wouldn't get extra parcels, probably. But I think they were all right. Our own men had been marched right across Germany. And very little accommodation given, but it was, would be summer. And they didn't seem to, I mean, they were very fit when we met them again in Poland.
So how long were you in? Anything else about the big camp you can remember?
The big camp?
6B.
Yes, the Germans behaved very badly there.
In what way?
I can't remember the whole thing, but there were different Germans mostly, and there was a quarrel between the people running the camp and the people came in from outside. And we had got the Swiss representing us and had a lot of complaints. And I think I've got it roughly right. Some various officers tried to escape with one or two very ingenious ways. A sort of carpenter used to come into the camp to do things, and he had a trolley load of stuff. Well, somebody imitated it with papier-mâché and got a trolley and dressed up like the German. He tried to get out, and he very nearly did. But more amusingly, a party of about 12 made of German clothes that looked like German clothes, and they made papier-mâché rifles. They tried to march out as soldiers. They got past a lot of people, and they did, I think they collapsed with laughter before they got to the gate. But it frightened the Germans. The Germans thought we had 12 rifles, ordered us to give them up, and of course we refused. And they put us on parade. They got some thugs from outside to come in and muck up the rooms. And some German officers that were trying to treat us fairly. They said, well, just go have somebody there. And I was one sent to my room after a bit and was able to stop. And what they did, they tipped everything on the floor and then poured water or jam or anything on it. It's worse than a burglary. Have you ever been burgled? But I mean, if anything you tipped in the room, and it's an awful sight. But particularly when things were spoiled or any food you'd saved up ruined and mixed up with your blankets and so on. And we got a big complaint about that put in. And things became normal. Masses of tunnels being made in every direction.
You still weren't involved in that side of things, though?
Yes, a lot of people. But mostly people were coffee housing with their friends and making others.
By coffee housing, you mean going round for a drink?
Going round for a drink and sharing food, etc., meeting friends. And later, things like cricket matches between this school and that school and so on. But I was there not very long, and they realised they couldn't get everybody in, and it was wrong. So they moved first the older people out, and I and other people that I knew went back to Spangenberg. And then after that, there was a pretty big escape organised via PT, and I got about 50 people over the wire, I think. And I think two got home via Holland. One escape, I don't think I'd say, when we moved out of Poland, one of our people, an RAF officer, I didn't know him very well, was left behind to be court-martialed by the Germans because he'd quarreled with the sergeant major or something, some escape. And somebody came to us at Spangenberg and told us that he'd got, a doctor came, and said he, the doctor, had got this chap out of the camp one day, and that he walked into the nearest Polish house, and there was a Swiss having supper. A Swede having supper, who was sailing to Sweden that night and took him. So he was home in England the next day, or something like that. But that was a complete freak, and very doubtful whether it was correct thing to do to walk into a Polish house, because if anybody discovered it, they'd all be shot. I mean, you're asking people a great deal. How this chap got home, and it's the only escape I know that was successful. That was wild luck and help by a doctor to start with.
So you went back to Spangenberg, to the
back
castle.
To Spangenberg, and fairly peaceful, and then the Americans began to get near, and we had an exciting time. We knew our guards knew the war was over.
How could you tell?
I don't know. They were fairly friendly. And we'd had two nasty spells with guards at Spangenberg. After a bit, we got a regular German sergeant. Regular army came, and we thought, oh, this is grand. We've got a real soldier. And he was very friendly, but one night fired umpteen shots through the window, and bullets going between your legs and your plane bridge. Just slight bit of light showing, you see, because our aeroplanes were going over to bomb Berlin. But we got the impression that all Germans, if you scratch them, would become nasty. And the worst one was some doctors in our camp did an escape. And they got a mile or two away in a hot day. And
how did they got out?
I can't remember. They must have been helped out somehow. I don't know how they got out. They reckoned they ought to be prisoners, the doctors. But they were got caught or gave it were farmers. And two very old, 60-year-old soldiers regarding us were sent out to get them back, and when they got near them, they just undid their rifles and clubbed them and crashed them out the head with it. And outrageous. No war on connected with us or anything. just because they had to walk 2 miles to bring them back to camp. All sorts of episodes like that were reported. And the most extraordinary thing that people hadn't heard of is the Germans sent somebody to talk to us. It must have been fairly near the end of the war, I suppose. He was an Irish professor and knew English, and he somehow in Germany. But he was a nice person, but made a suggestion to all these fairly senior officers. Spangler were fairly old, 40s, and most in majors or colonels. Some of them were more important. General Fortune had been there, there was full colonels. We should all write home begging the government to join the Germans in shoving the Russians back into Russia. And of course we didn't. That was debated, and we put in to this man, how could we join the Germans when we knew about all these camps and killing millions of Jews and ill-treating various people.
When did you found out about that? Or had you known?
We knew from wireless, I think, German papers a bit. We did know. There was somebody shouting as we moved by train, and seeing a train full of people with sort of Nachgatta or Gacka. I mean, they knew the names of some of the camps. And I think the Jones was gone too, without any doubt. It was a fairly serious moment. And then when the Americans got near, we realized we'd have to march, and we'd heard that a number of people marching on the other side of Germany had been shot up by planes from the air. It didn't matter whether they were German planes or American or British, you couldn't tell. A straggling mass of people on the roads would be shot. And we hadn't anything to carry our goods with. I made a rucksack with a pair of trousers. And we've got all this part to put in, and one thing I said, and the legs come over your trousers. Tiny bit of sewing, it's done. I made a haversack with a pair of shorts. Tiny bit of sewing, all stringing, stop things falling out. But we had march. We refused to march by day because it was too dangerous. We'd be shot from the air. And they marched by night. And after 2 days, we refused because I think after the second night, it wasn't hilly country, but going on any hill high on about 47 others, and it really hurt quite a lot to put a step up a hill at all.
Why was that?
I don't know. Something to do with, I'd lost a stone and a half in the last few months. The Germans got frightened of something. They had 14 million foreigners working in Germany, prisoners of war and foreigners of various kinds. And somebody said they were frightened of some kind of uprising organized by the British around Red Cross parcels, because there were great dumps of Red Cross parcels in various places. And it wasn't such a wild idea. One of our officers, we wondered what would happen to Germany when the armies, British, got there. And one officer suggested that the various men's camps, stalags, hadn't any officers in charge of them, and he would like to go as a PT or somebody. And General Portland took up the idea, and a lot of us volunteered to go. And I was delighted to be chosen. I had 3 or 4 at my age. I was chosen in front of the leader of a whole party had been captured at St. Nazaire, a raid in France, and the colonel, whom I knew very well, got a VC for it. I was chosen one above him, anyway. And he was 10, 15 years younger. But I think what they wanted was a sense, a reliable sense, because nobody knew what the problems would be. And I don't know what they were.
So you were intended to go in and run the camp, the British side of the camp, as a senior British officer, well, the only British officer in a men's camp.
The only officer, try and help them, because there might be all sorts of problems, like are they to march towards the British, or stay where they were, or steal, or they might even be shot or something. Goodness knows what. But it was an idea.
So you were picked, but did anything come of it?
No. The Germans thought it was a good idea, and then I think they thought it was perhaps part of the plot to raise revolution.